Good evening and welcome to the Professional Learning for Teachers channel on Radio Edutalk. My name is David Noble in Dalgety Bay as ever and delighted to have on the show this evening Dr. Margaret Sutherland of the University of Glasgow, and this evening we'll be hearing from Margaret on the topic of improving the educational experiences of highly able pupils in the early years. Good evening, Margaret.
Good evening, David. Good to be here.
That's fantastic. Delighted to have you on EduTalk. And over the next half hour or so, we'll be talking around this subject. And if you are listening to the live stream or the podcast, there's some extra information or background information available. If you go to edutalk.cc and go to the homepage, there's a blue bar near the top of the page, and it says somewhere in there it says click here for key links. So you might want to do that just as we're going through the early stages of tonight's show. You might want to have that in front of you if you're sitting at a computer. Margaret's kindly given us some recommended reading and also some key links to the many pieces of work that Margaret's done in this area. You've also posed three questions, Margaret, to listeners this evening. If you don't mind, I'll just quickly read them out just now. Firstly, Margaret, you're asking, how do you balance not labelling at an early age but ensure that young, highly able learners are challenged? Secondly, how do you support highly able young learners at transition time? And finally, do concerns about the social and emotional development of highly able young learners outweigh concerns about how to develop highly able young learners academically? So as you're listening, or even after the show, if you'd like to make a comment or a follow-up question based on these questions or anything else that Margaret has to say over the next half an hour or so, you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can just put your comment or question there and include the hashtag edutalk. So I think that's us all set now, Margaret. Could you just maybe start off by giving us a kind of brief background to your career in education?
Yes, of course. I started life as a primary teacher. I graduated from Jordan Hill College of Education, as it was then. I graduated in 1981, so I've been teaching for a long time, 33 years. I worked in primary schools across the stages, and during that time I met a number of children, as you do, who present sometimes as a challenge, either because of their learning or their behaviour. And I was very, very interested in these children, children with dyslexia, for example, one of the first little boys that I worked with. They got me interested in the whole area of additional support for learning. I then went on to work with children in a mainstream school who were looked after and accommodated, and I became very involved with them, and a number of them were very challenging sometimes in terms of behaviour. And after that, I became a behaviour support teacher and worked in mainstream schools. And I went back into primary schools into the early years, and that's probably my real love is early years. And I had a great time working in a primary school there. And I then went on secondment, because I really had never thought about working with adults. But I went on secondment to what was at that point St Andrew's Teacher Training, Education College rather, and eventually, long story short, the post was advertised as a permanent post. I applied for it, I got it, we merged with Glasgow University, and here I am tonight, a member of staff at the University of Glasgow. So that's a little potted history of where I've been and what I've done.
Thanks very much. And so just getting on to the topic again, I'll just read it out one more time. We're talking about improving the educational experiences of highly able pupils in the early years. Can you say a bit more about, you know, how you got into this and what kind of key texts have influenced you down the years before we then maybe start to talk about what we actually mean here, kind of define our terms?
And I suppose I became very interested in learners who were just a bit different and who you had to think really hard about sometimes. And during my time as a behaviour support teacher, many of the children I supported were children with chaotic lives at home, very very difficult and challenging life experiences. And they presented with very difficult and challenging behaviour often in schools. But there were a couple of young people that I was asked to support where that pattern didn't fit them. And the more that I started to look at these children and talk to their teachers, you suddenly realised their issue was actually the curriculum. And these children were just not challenged in any way, shape or form. And they turned to being incredibly creative and incredibly highly able at creating chaos in classrooms. And I became really quite interested in that. And then when I went back into early years, there was a little girl in my primary one class there who came in as a non-reader in August, but by Christmas time was reading novels of an eight-year-old. And again, you're kind of left going, well, what's this about? What do I do with this? And I suppose both of these experiences made me really start to think about children who did things that had you going, my goodness, because they were doing it when you hadn't really expected it. And so that's where my original interest came around the idea of highly able pupils, as we would call them here in Scotland. A key text, I think, for me, I was actually asked to speak about this at a conference a couple of years ago, and it was a conference around gifted and talented education, because that's what this would be known as in most of the world, with the exceptions of Wales, actually, is gifted and talented. And I spoke about a book that doesn't mention gifted and talented, and it's a book called Special Teaching for Special Children. And it gets you to think about a whole range of labels, autism, you name it, the labels there. And really that book, I think, is a very challenging book, because at the end of the day, what you end up talking about, regardless of the label, is pedagogy. And for me, that's very true for this whole field of gifted and talented as well. So that's a book, I think, that's heavily influenced my thinking.
And you touched on the terminology that's used in Scotland and the differences throughout the world. I mean, we had highly able and gifted versus gifted and talented. And when I was doing a bit of background reading for tonight, it reminded me about literature on more able or even the exceptionally able. So can you touch on that? I suppose most of our listeners are based in Scotland, so it'd be good if we kind of based that around highly able. But then touch on whether it's more than subtle differences internationally in terms of the terminology differences.
I mean, any label comes with baggage, and these labels, all the ones you've mentioned there, are no different. And I think in Scotland, I think, is very interesting for a whole number of reasons. Legislation-wise, these children come under the Additional Support for Learning Act, which is great, and in my view is a good place for them to be. And the Scottish Network for Able Pupils, which is an organisation based in the University of Glasgow, we wrote guidelines, non-statutory guidelines for schools. And one of the things we wrestled with was what to call them, because you kind of have to call them something. And we, in conjunction actually with HMI, we discussed this with them. And the term that we kind of settled on, and one that the HMI were comfortable with too, was this idea of high label. Now, it's not unproblematic either. But Scotland believes herself, I think, or itself, to be a very egalitarian country. And unfortunately, I think, and wrongly, the whole field of gifted and talented education has been linked with elitism. Now, I understand why that's happened, but I think it's a bit of a pity. But if you're a very egalitarian country, you really can't do anything that's elitist. And so to call it gifted and talented, or to call these children, this group of learners, gifted and talented, doesn't sit easily with our kind of Scottish psyche. And so we've never used the expression gifted and talented. And one, the term that we are using just now is highly able. Interestingly, I think there is a bit of a shift internationally. I mentioned Wales. Wales call them talented and more able. Most other places do refer to gifted and talented. Some people have a problem with the term gifted, because gift implies a giver, and for some people that's problematic. There's a move to just using the word talented, but that, with Britain's Got Talent and the X Factor, is that what we're talking about? Well, it might be, but is that something else? Well, yes, it probably is as well. So all the labels, I think, are fraught with difficulties. And there's a wee bit of me, if I'm totally honest, David, I don't really much care what you call them, but I do think in schools we need to recognise we have children who are capable of doing more than we're asking them. Does that help?
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a great answer, Margaret. And did all this, the focus of the inspectorate and politicians and etc. and the education community at large, did it all start with The HMI report, the Education of Able Pupils P6 to S2 in 1993, or is there a longer history?
Well, I think we've always been interested in raising attainment in Scotland, and I think we still are interested in raising attainment and achievement, and I think that fits this agenda beautifully. That's where what this is part of, I think. And I think that was quite a key document. It's the only document, really, that's come out that specifically addressed these pupils and their needs. And to kind of paraphrase a little, but the document said that, rightly, in the 1980s, we'd spent a lot of time, money and energy on children who were struggling and who needed support, and nobody was arguing that we shouldn't have done or shouldn't be doing that. But it said it was kind of done in the belief that highly able children get on in spite of you. And in actual fact, we know that that's actually not the case. And the document was really making a plea that we started to think about these pupils just in the same way that we think about any other learner that has a particular need. And then through the 90s, there was a whole raft of legislation that came out, and highly able pupils are still in there. You know, in Child at the Centre, well, we have to include highly able children. Count as in, all these documents, if highly able pupils aren't in count as in, then the document for them is count as out. So they're there, but you need to know they're there, you need to want to look for them. And so the kind of, the very specific reference to them disappeared. And then again in 2004, when the Additional Support for Learning Act came out, that wasn't just simply about a change of terminology from special educational needs to additional support for learning, but was actually a different way about thinking, philosophically different, about who needs support and how do we support them and so on. Learners that just didn't sit well under the special educational need banner, like children for whom English is an additional language, children who were bereaved, looked after and accommodated, highly able, they didn't sit well under SEN. But actually, if we look at at learning differently, then these children actually have a place at the table, if you like. So for us, the 2004 Additional Support for Learning Act was a really exciting time when it came out with the needs of these children specifically mentioned. That just brought them back into to focus perhaps a little bit.
And before we find out, you know, how schools have changed and how practices have changed in recent years, maybe going back a bit, or maybe these could be ongoing problems, but what have parents and carers and pupils themselves been reporting down the years as being the problems within schools, you know, either in class or relationships with staff, or more systemic? You know, how has their potential in life been stunted or restricted?
Well, they're like everybody else, they're individuals and they don't all react in the same way. But I mean, sometimes if you never get a chance to show what you can do, if you're asked, as some children, we know stories of children who, you know, the teacher will say things like, oh, I know, you know, don't answer this one. And very quickly you learn just to shut up. You don't put your hand up. You don't raise your head above the parapet. You just keep quiet. Amongst your peers, well, you know, you might not want to always get 10 out of 10. There's a bit of a stigma around this. And actual fact, these children, if you look at them in the media, for example, you know, nerds and geeks are words that are used sometimes to describe this group of learners. And often, although I have to say the Big Bang series maybe had a wee bit of an impact here, Sheldon is actually quite well liked for being the nerd. But by and large, children, young people don't want to be the nerd and the geek. If you look at the American sitcoms, I think with the exception of the Orange County, you know, you don't get the good-looking girl or boy. You're not the popular one. You're not in the cheerleading team. So there's a bit of an issue sometimes for children and young people who are really, really good at something or a whole range of things, and there can be a tendency to just kind of hide your light, just keep your head down. There's a bit of a Scottish culture thing in there too, where you just get on with it. So there's a whole host of things, I think, that come into play. Sometimes these children, young people, become behaviour problems, like the one of the children that I mentioned earlier that kind of got me interested in the area, where, you know, he just had great fun winding everybody up, the class clown, and he was really good at it. But his learning was not being challenged. And I think that document that came out, you know, well, I my colleague I work with, George Head, has talked a lot about the document should have really been called Better Learning, Better Behaviour. But that kind of idea that if we can address the learning, the behaviour will actually often settle down. So there's a whole range of issues for parents and for children, for young people. We get a lot of phone calls from parents too, and I can maybe talk about that later if that's appropriate for you or interesting for you.
Yeah, that would be great. And would we say that these are all examples of hidden underachievement?
I think there's sometimes hidden underachievement, and then I think we actually also have young people who are doing very, very well. I had a parent once who phoned me and said, you know, Margaret, can you help me? I really don't know how to go and speak to the school. Her daughter had been the Ducks of the school, and there are junior Ducks and a senior Ducks, and she'd been the junior Ducks. So this girl was clearly academically doing incredibly well. But she was not even having to lift her little finger to do this well. She just did it. She didn't study. Nothing was a challenge for her. It just all came easy, and she just got these top marks all the time. And she was actually quite fed up in school. She was quite bored in school. And her mum said, well, what did I go and say to the school? Because, you know, rightly, you can imagine the school saying, but she's a Duck for the school. What more do you want? And in actual fact, the girl's learning, she could have been doing much, much more in-depth learning, much more breadth and depth to her learning. So there's hidden underachievers, and then there's people that would appear to be doing very, very well, but one of our arguments would be, well, maybe how much better could they be doing?
Yeah, and I mean, we don't have lots of time this evening, Margaret, and I've got so many questions to put to you. It would be fascinating now, I think, to move on to actually how school cultures have been changing, and you know, you have an ethos where everybody's supposed to thrive, everybody knows what they're meant to be doing to achieve that end. And I know that one project that you were heavily involved in, and the details are on the SNAP website, was the Auchinairn school project. And that's a school in Eastern Bartonshire, I believe. So
How
did their policy come together, and can you say a bit about the impact on practices?
Well, actually, that's actually quite interesting. I didn't know Auchinairn had written their policy. And I was actually just surfing around on the internet for something one day, and whatever words I put into Google brought up Auchinairn. And I thought, oh my goodness, because I know Auchinairn, and I know schools in Eastern Barton very well. And I clicked on the link, and I was reading. I thought, oh my goodness, oh, they're quoting us. Oh, that's fantastic, because you can do that. We don't, you know, it's nice if we know, but you don't have to have our permission or anything to quote us. And not long after, actually, I had found this policy. I was asked if I would actually go in and do some in service with the teachers one day, because we would do that. And I had a great time in the school talking about their policy, looking at some practices, taking some other ideas, some things that we've gleaned from work we've done or conferences we've been at, people we've spoken to. And together, we very much kind of worked from where the school is at. And the school, I think, like many schools, we're looking at their whole learning and teaching policy. We're thinking about all learners and recognise that this was a group that they had to specifically think about. SNAP wouldn't advocate that you have to have a policy on able pupils, but we would be suggesting that you need to know where they do sit within any existing policies that you have.
That's what really struck me with the Auchinairn policy, is it was clearly something for all learners in there. It didn't make people out to be different or special as such.
Young people don't want to be different and special.
Yeah, of course.
they want to be the same. And in actual fact, you know, for me, what makes a challenging experience for a high-level learner, whether they're in early years or otherwise, is it's about the depth, it's about the content, it's about maybe the text you give them, it's about the outcome you look for. The actual way that you do learning and teaching with these learners, when you look at the research around, you know, what do able pupils say was good, you know, able pupils that have left and are reflecting back, what did you like? It's all the stuff we're trying to do with all pupils. There's nothing magic or special. It's a bit like special education. You know, people used to think that in a special education school you did something really different. And I can vividly remember walking in to the first school, first time I'd been in a school, and I thought, oh, that's the reading scheme I use. Oh, that's the computer, but we used it differently. And I think there's something about looking at how you use resources and things with young people, and that's true for highly able learners as well.
There was a few aspects of the policy that really stuck out for me. And I'm just wondering if you can say a bit about where you've maybe seen this elsewhere. Said about the importance of mentoring these young people, about encouraging them to challenge themselves, which I found that fascinating within a school context. The importance of homework, and I know that in many authorities just now there's great discussions about what form homework takes now and whether that's going to stretch the high-level pupils, and also around enrichment of the individual's lives, the individual's learning opportunities, but also the curriculum. And you've touched on about how the curriculum can often be unsatisfactory or not stretch them enough. So can you give us other examples of where that's maybe worked elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of those things you mentioned, I'll touch on the homework one first. I mean, Auchinairn obviously used the SNAP guidance that was there, and as I say, I've done in service with them, but they developed a policy that is appropriate for them. I actually once said, I was invited to speak at a Parent Teachers Association meeting one night, and I actually, almost as a throwaway statement, said, actually, do you know, if I was your head teacher, I might actually just abolish homework. To me, it causes a terrible lot of stress sometimes in households, and parents are crying and children are crying and it's not done properly. And, you know, I wasn't there to talk about homework, so it was a passing kind of comment. And I could see the look in the teacher's faces of, oh, my goodness, what she said. And a look in the parents' faces of, oh, my goodness. But actually what ensued in that school was a huge discussion, because the teachers all said to the parents, we thought you wanted homework. And the parents all said, well, we thought you wanted to do it. And they actually started to talk about what is meaningful homework, because unfortunately, I'm still hearing of schools that have given out, you know, write out a sentence and with the six words and do four sums. And I don't think that kind of homework is helpful for anybody, and certainly maybe not for highly able pupils. So if there is homework being given, and if schools are doing that, absolutely fine. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I do think we need to think about what it is and if it actually takes anybody's learning forward, and that would be true for highly able pupils. In terms of challenging themselves, there's a lot of the literature would say that sometimes highly able pupils, some highly able pupils don't like to get things wrong. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is taking children to the point of failure, but you need to know that it's safe to fail.
Yeah.
The whole idea of challenging yourself, so you did this last time, what are you going to do this time? And again, that's true for all children, about helping them to take forward from where they're at. Competition has a place, but it's not always helpful. But certainly that competition against yourself kind of idea, I think, is quite interesting. I think some of that work, the Carol Dweck work on mindsets and so on, we certainly would talk a lot about the kind of feedback that young, all children, I mean, I know the title of tonight's talk was young children. We've not really talked particularly about young children. But, we would talk about all children needing the kind of feedback where they know that it's about the effort they've put in, it's about the way they approach the task. It was all these things that made the task successful. It's not that, oh, you're very clever. Because certainly the research would show that where they're trying to constantly prove to you that they're very clever, they'll avoid anything that does exactly what we've been talking about there, challenging themselves.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing is about making you realise how clever they are, and to keep that thought at the front of your mind. Look, you said I'm clever, and look how clever I am. So I think we do need to take all children to the point of failure, but you need to know it's safe to fail. So I think that challenging yourself is very important. For some, the girl that I mentioned that was the ducks of the school, that's not really putting in a whole lot of effort to be the ducks in the school, you know, when's the first time she's going to meet something very challenging that she maybe can't do? And if that's university, that's a hard lesson to learn at that point. And I certainly have spoken to colleagues across the university in some of our schools and colleges where you need, very, very high, 5, 6 A's or whatever it is to get in to do the course. And young people saying, I'm not clever enough to be here to do this. Now, that's actually just not right. But their whole approach to learning, I think, helping them to understand how they learn all that metacognition stuff is very, very important. Do you want me to go on, or do you want
it's great, Margaret. I'm thinking we better touch on the early year settings then, because I'm sure some listeners will be kind of tuning in and specifically to hear about
it. One of my arguments to bring in the early years thing, I suppose one of my arguments, and in fact one of the things I've written about, is the notion of developing the title of the book, because of the publishers had to have gifted and talented in it, but developing the young learner, the highly able young learner. And I believe passionately that young children in a nursery school or a nursery class should leave nursery going, my goodness, that learning stuff was brilliant. Where is it I go to do the next bit of this? And I think very much how the kinds of opportunities that we create within early years, letting children find out what it is they are good at, what they can do. You know, how do you know if you've got a propensity towards playing the piano if nobody's sat you down at a piano? So letting children have opportunities to explore and to discover about themselves and about learning and about how good learning can be. And I think if we can develop those kind of dispositions, learning dispositions within young children, then that is a really good foundational starting point for children to move on.
Mm-hmm. That's great stuff, Margaret. And one of the quotes in the, again, I think it was back to something on the SNAP website, it said, personal interaction between teacher and pupil is important to find non-obvious talents, and that might be the piano playing, I suppose. And I'm just wondering how difficult that might be these days to find that time and space to you know, work on that relationship and actually find out, you know, what the young person might be interested in or may have a talent in.
Well, it does strike me that at the heart of teaching and learning is actually relationships. I think teaching and learning is about relationships, and I think the relationship between a teacher and a learner is absolutely crucial. It's one of the things we would talk to our postgraduate and our undergraduate students about a lot, and how do you develop that? And I mean, I know there was stuff out today on the web, on the BBC website about curriculum for excellence and teacher stress, and I don't want to get into discussing all of that. That's not what tonight's about. But I suppose it's to acknowledge that there have been huge changes in education recently. But I do think some of the changes that we've made have been good, and I would like to hope that teachers take the opportunity that curriculum for excellence seems to be offering them to create good learning opportunities, to let children find out what they can do, to spend time developing relationships. Because in actual fact, I think learning will get better if we take time to develop these relationships. So relationships are a key part of all of this, I think.
And these relationships really, I think you're suggesting, have to be with other communities or within the local community, and may even be online as well as physical.
Yeah. I mean, we would talk, I guess, about kind of layers of support. I think there's a lot that an early years practitioner, covering their nursery and early years, there's an awful lot an early years practitioner can do, but they can't do it all. And eventually, I think it becomes not just the practitioner's issue, what are you going to do with this child in your nursery, your class, but it's actually part of a bigger question is, well, what do we actually do with a child like this in our school? And it becomes a school issue. And then actually I think it becomes an authority issue. What are we going to do with a child like this in our authority? Because I'll guarantee there's not just one of them in the authority, there will be a number. And then the authority may actually say, well, actually, where do we go for the next level of support? Now, that might be a university, it might be some professional body, it might be the Institute of Physics, it might be... You know, and there are an amazing number of sources out there that are willing to help and support, and that can offer help and support, and or have activities, etc., that you can engage in. And clearly, online is opening that up in a way that we haven't had before.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming into the last 5 minutes or so of tonight's show. I'm going to try and stretch it slightly more, Margaret, if you don't mind. But let me know if you need to head off soon. I'll just remind listeners that there's two ways you can get in touch. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can include the hashtag edutalk. And there's a key role here for education support staff, and I think in a lot of the literature we're talking about the need for support for learning departments and staff to play a key role, amongst other things, in the kind of initial and ongoing assessment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a hugely interesting group, fascinating group to work with, but they're not an easily definable group. I think how you find them, where you find them, how you have to find them varies from place to place. There's a lot that's dependent on the educator's understanding. I once was in a nursery and I said to the member of staff, I said, have you ever worked with a young child with outstanding ability? And I was trying to avoid all those labels that we discussed earlier, you know, gifted and talented or any of these things. So I went for young child with outstanding ability. And she sat and she thought for a minute and she went, no, and certainly not in this area. Now, it was an area of deprivation. And I sat and my heart sank because I thought, oh my goodness, you're not going to look for them because you don't believe they're there. And if you find one, you might not even notice. You might be surprised and go, oh my goodness, but do nothing about it. We spend a lot of time getting staff to think about what all of this means. For us, it's not as simple as giving out an IQ test and getting an IQ score of 140 plus and saying, well, that's our highly able pupil. Now, it tells you something, it just doesn't tell you everything. But I do think there's a range of ways that we can try to identify children who are needing challenge, who are needing that next step. And certainly, as I say, the key thing is getting staff to think about them and not just think, oh, they'll be fine, they're clever. And to then not see them as, oh my goodness, another group we have to cater for, but to say, okay, what can we do to support this group of learners? Because actually, in fact, you identified this earlier in the programme, I think, that many of the things that you do for this group of learners are just good for everybody. That's not to say they get the same out of it. But what you do is not any different. So it might be differentiation by outcome or by text or that you give them to read or that kind of thing. So I think there's lots of things we can do if we want to do it.
And is it a case of the identification, in your experience in Scotland, the identification where it hasn't existed before, coming from staff observations within school, then eventually, you know, reaching a level where it becomes part of the kind of group think in the staff room, and then something's maybe done to provide additional support or just better teaching and learning all round, are there mechanisms in schools and authorities for parents and carers to actually say, no, I believe that my child is gifted?
I mean, this group of learners are no different from any other group of learners. So as a parent might come to a school and say, I think my child's dyslexic, they might equally come, although I would argue perhaps sometimes they find it harder to come and say, I think my child's highly able. And some of that's about the parent saying, I mean, I've had many, many conversations with parents on the phone, and they'll say, I mean, I don't know that he's gifted, but he is quite clever. And it is, you know, and that's what I mean, I'm not that interested in the label. You know, if the child is quite clever, whatever that might mean, then we need to acknowledge that, we need to challenge that. I think there's a great need for schools and parents and a whole range of organisations to work together. And it's not that the school and the parent ought to be against each other, but the parents get information the school might not have, and vice versa. And I think for us it's about gathering a whole lot of information, getting a holistic picture of the child. So, and actually talking to the children themselves, and talking to their peers. You know, children, and I've done work like this in nurseries, they're very good at telling you who's good at things. Gathering all of that evidence, and maybe standardised tests too, all of these things have their place, but you need to pull it all together. We firmly believe that schools are in possession of an awful lot of information, but they sometimes just don't always pull it all together to see what it says. And I think that's true for this group of learners. And I think if you pull all of that together, see what it's telling you, talk to parents, keep the dialogue open, talk to the children. And don't get me wrong, these children can be incredibly challenging. And they're not slow, some of them, to tell you you're wrong when you say something. Now, depending on what kind of teacher you are, that can be hard to take. But certainly in my experience, you just have to go, do you know what? You are right. You know more about this than I do. And then, but gathering all of this information together to inform your planning the kind of planning you'd be doing for any group of learners in your class.
Mm-hmm. You've given us so many great examples of effective practice and kind of setting up an appropriate ethos throughout a school, Margaret. I'm just wondering if we can just touch briefly on the kind of best practices around nursery to primary transition.
Yeah, we've done a little bit of work in this area in some authorities, and in fact there's an early years report that we didn't set out to look at transition, but it was obviously something that came up. And I kind of don't know where I am in this at the moment. We've been doing quite a lot of thinking and talking and reading, and we've not written anything yet because we're still kind of forming our thoughts. But I think transition times for anybody are difficult. We know that, and absolutely we need to support children. But I do wonder sometimes if we're trying to make something seamless that actually isn't seamless. Nurseries are very different forms of organisations from a primary school, and certainly nurseries that we've had the privilege of working in over the last few years. You know, even just think, let's take parents as an example. Engaging with parents is a whole different way of doing it in the morning with them, in pop in any time, just, you know, and the door, well, there's obviously locks in the door, but, you know, come any time, the door's open, somebody comes off the floor, takes time to speak to you. That just doesn't and can't happen in a primary school because a primary school is different. And I wonder sometimes if we're trying to make something seamless that really can't be completely seamless. Do I think we're doing good things in transition? Yes, I do. But I think all the problems that you get at that kind of P7 into S1 transition phase, where primary 7 teachers complain that secondary teachers never look at the reports, well, actually, you get the same in nursery. Nursery people complaining that primary people don't look at them. I'm not advocating clean slate here, but I do think, I do wonder at one point we came across, it's not in use now, but there was a 52-page transition document. Now, as a primary one teacher, I couldn't have looked at 25 of those and taken it all in. So I don't know. The jury's out for me just now in this whole area of transition, other than to say, yes, I think it's important, and yes, I think good things are happening in places. And I certainly think one of the things that we need to recognise is the learning that happens in nurseries and how in primaries we can build on that learning. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it's a great...
Where the state of my mind is.
Yeah, it's a difficult area. And just finally, Margaret, just to wrap up, can you just tell us a bit more about SNAP then, about the aims and resources that are available on the website and elsewhere, what kind of activities you're involved in, and the support, and I believe there's the support that's available for parents and carers as well.
Yes, SNAP has been around for a wee while, and we're obviously part of a research-led university, and so one aspect of what we do would be research and papers and stuff and kind of feeding into that arm. But our work is firmly rooted as well in schools. In fact, just this week we've had school pupils from nursery, from primary, from secondary out working with us in the university. We've been working in an authority with staff this year, and they've gone off to do various projects, and the pupils have come to report on those. So we would engage in that level. We offer continuing, now what's the new title, CLPD, whether that's a career-long professional development courses. We've run a couple of those this year in the university, and we have an annual conference as well. We usually have an international speaker at that. So there's lots of those kinds of opportunities going on. I also, myself and my colleague, have also been in schools working in service days, twilight sessions and so on. Now, nature of the beast, we do have to charge for these things, but we offer bespoke stuff. So it's where is your school at, where is your nursery at, and how can we come and help you? We get phone calls from parents. Parents troll around the website and they find us, and we offer a listening ear, I guess, to parents of pupils of high ability. And contrary to belief, the parents that contact us, I would not describe any of them as pushy parents. They are parents who are genuinely concerned about their young child or their children, how they can help them, how they can support them, and importantly, how to approach a school. They know, they understand that teachers are dealing with children who can't read. Why would they want to speak to me with my 5-year-old who's reading like a 10-year-old? They understand the pressure that teachers are under, but nonetheless, it's their child, and their child, as the Education Act would tell us, deserve to have their talents and develop to the I hate that phrase, fullest potential, but anyway, they certainly deserve to have their potential developed. I don't think potential is something that's ever full, by the way. So SNAP does a lot of things. We also have an associate tutor scheme. A number of authorities buy into that, and within these authorities there are people who have come and worked with us, many of them over a number of years now, who are a point of contact within the authority for schools to go to. So there's a whole range of things, and as you say, they can find out more on the website. We'd be delighted if they contact us. We have an email address, and we would love to hear from people. And another wee plea, perhaps, if anybody's listening or hears us later, and we'd love to hear what you're doing. Schools are doing a whole lot of good stuff, but they maybe don't label it as being good for able pupils, but my goodness, it is good. And we're awful guilty of doing that Scottish thing of just not talking about it. So we'd love to hear from them.
No, it's quite a long web address, I believe, Margaret. So will I just say that people should just use a search engine and type in Scottish Network for Able Pupils?
It's www.ablepupils.com.
Ah, okay. I'm looking at a different web address. That's right.
If you type in www.ablepupils.com, you'll find us, or just Scottish Network for Able Pupils.
That's absolutely brilliant. Well, best wishes with your ongoing work, Margaret. It's been fascinating having you on EduTalk this evening, and lots of
good luck with EduTalk too. Doing some great stuff there as well. So
that's
thank
great.
You for including us.
That's brilliant, Margaret, and I'll just remind listeners that if they go to the EduTalk website, they'll be able to access some links to some of your writing and some key texts that are out there. I know that you've written extensively chapters and books in the field.
Great, thank you very much. Lovely to speak with you, David.
Thanks, Margaret. All the best. Bye now.
And you. Bye-bye.